Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 2nd of March 2014. My name's TRP Watson. This week I'm joined by Johnny Fox, Web Cowgirl, The Paul in London, Nick from Partially Obstructive View, and Judy Raby.
We're now going to talk about You're in Town, which is on at the St James's Theatre. John, no, I won't do that joke. Sorry, I can't do that joke. John, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
I think we first have to decide some ground rules about whether or not this is just going to be an endless succession of piss jokes or if we're actually going to talk about the thing.
Let's talk about the thing.
Let's talk about the thing. You're in Town is a musical which has hung around like a bat. No, can't do that one either.
Start again.
You're in Town is a slightly stale...
You want to introduce it?
That won't work either.
It didn't make me laugh.
All right. Well, neither did the show. You're in Town emerged as a musical in an off-Broadway situation about 12 or 13 years ago, and I saw it in, I think, 2002, in a non-traditional, very sort of wooden box type theatre somewhere off Sixth Avenue, and I really, really did not like it. I didn't understand the plot, I didn't like any of the characters, I didn't get what it was all about, and the songs were completely forgettable. But it ran for years and years and years, perhaps because it was a small venue, but also because it was something of a phenomenon. You know, it was a political piece about a dystopian future that Americans certainly weren't seeing a lot of on mainstream stages. So that's what it's about. It's about a vision of a future where society is broken down and you have a huge underclass and everything has been privatised. And no, it's not a joke about the coalition. Everything has been privatised, including the right to go to the bathroom. And so you must use a public urinal. I'm not going to say urinal, but you must use a public urinal. And these are priced out of almost everybody's financial means. So when you're desperate and you really do need to go, and you can't afford to use a public facility, you are carted off to somewhere called Urine Town, which is meant to be a kind of Guantanamo Bay sort of internment place, but actually we think it's probably a euphemism for people just being taken away and disposed of. So far, so hilarious, right? It's then dressed with a wonderful... In the British production, I think they've taken the... No, I can't do that one. I think they have spoofed the story a little bit by over-dramatising it, by upping the sort of melodramatic content and setting it in an absolutely wonderful set by Sutra Gilmore. We sat about four or five rows back from it and it felt absolutely real apart from the smell. It is a wonderful melange of a sort of bit of French pissoir, a bit of American street grime, and a bit of theatrical revolve, and I really, really liked it. I liked everything about the show, apart from the central content. I thought the staging was magnificent. I think some of the performances are really fantastic. I think Jenna Russell is having the time of her life playing the Chatelaine of the toilet. I think Richard Fleischman is also enjoying himself hugely as this muscle-bound lavatory attendant and love interest of one of the smaller female characters. And I think Jonathan Slinger makes a much better Officer Lostock than the American guy I saw do it on Broadway. Beyond that, there's some terrific costuming. There's a lot of sort of wet vinyl theme going on, and everybody's wearing Wellingtons, and it's a little bit dark, it's a little bit wet, it's a little bit dirty, and I think it's a little bit sexy. What lets it down, of course, is that the plot is old, and the music isn't very memorable, apart from the fact that there's one really rousing gospel number that I did kind of find myself humming going back home on the tube, and they do what they do extremely well. I think it will be popular. I think it will run full. Oh, that's another one we can't do. Yeah, well, bladder half full then for me.
My take on this show is that it's the producer's follow-up to Springtime for Hitler, a sort of combination of the daftness of Finian's Rainbow and the charm and humor of 1984, combined with absolutely forgettable songs. There were exactly two numbers in it, one right after another, that actually had some real pizzazz to it. And I sat there watching this thing that had certainly had a lot of money thrown at it. We had a very well-designed set. We had a full complement of characters, and the people performing were really top-notch. But the show just didn't have a thing in it that resonated with me. It was boring, and I felt like I was the victim of some terrible joke of people who had deliberately tried to come up with a show that nobody would want to see. It's about people wanting to take a piss, which they do on stage. And I'm just like, this is supposed to be popular. It's got to be a joke on us. And when I heard that John had actually enjoyed this show, I was actually quite surprised because I found it utterly devoid of merit. And, you know, I can enjoy a good amount of potty humor as much as the next person. And in the case of this crowd, probably all of us. But really, after 5 minutes, aside from waiting for them to make the very obvious comment about spending a penny, which never happened, because in fact the penny never dropped, I could not find anything to enjoy about this show.
Well, Jenna Russell's character is called Miss Pennywise, which I assume is a reference to spending a penny.
Yeah, except, of course, that would be an American joke. And it was an American play, and it's not an American joke to say spending a penny, although it is waiting for when the penny dropped is an American phrase.
I don't know. Had they anglicized it? Have they changed it, John? Was she Miss Pennywise in the States?
Yeah, she was.
Okay.
No, I'm with you. I didn't like this either. I thought at the first 5 minutes, I thought, oh, actually, I'm going to really enjoy this, because there's a sort of fourth wall breaking of the Officer Lockstock played by Jonathan Slinger, who I thought did it rather well. It sort of tells us that we're watching a musical and, you know, there's going to be certain things that they have to stick to. But then within that, they don't stick to it in the sense that for a musical comedy, which I suppose is meant to be a comedy, although I didn't find it funny at all, they have a very, very dark ending. It goes off in a direction I really didn't expect. But with, like you, I was quite bored by it. The crowd there the night I went absolutely loved it, and I think it's going to be quite a hit. I agree, the staging's excellent. It looks fantastic. Sutra Gilmore's set, I agree with you, John, is terrific. The groupings that they use around it are quite sort of Les Miserables, and then there's a sort of parody of the flag-waving revolution in that, and even, I think, a nod to Billy Elliot with the riot shield kind of stuff. But one of the big problems I had was the sound in the ensemble numbers. I just couldn't hear what they were singing at all. And I know it was a preview, but I just think, you know, that's inexcusable, even at preview stage, not to be able to hear what they're singing. I do agree about the gospel number, but, you know, gospel numbers are always crowd pleasers. That was kind of quite rousing. I thought Richard Fleischman was excellent in it. You know, he looks very good and he sings very well. And you do kind of sort of believe in his character. But there's that dreadful song in the second act about the rabbits, which I just didn't get at all. And I assume it was meant to be funny, but I just almost wanted to look away in embarrassment at it.
Paul, what did you think?
Well, it's interesting, actually, because like I've been aware of the recording of the show for some years, and the most popular number is the big gospel-style number, Run, Freedom, Run, in the second act. But what's interesting about the piece as a piece of music is that obviously the creators, Greg Kotas, who did the lyrics, and composer and lyricist Mark Holman were obviously big fans of Kurt Weill, and they obviously also were inspired by Bertolt Brecht as well. So you've got to kind of get the sense that this show set out to be sort of a three-penny opera or cradle will rock follow-on from that, where you've got this dystopia where people are oppressed and so forth. But actually, 12 years on from when it was first created, it does seem like it hasn't held up as well as other shows that came out at its time. It lost out to a Tony for Best Musical to Thoroughly Modern Millie. So that gives you a sense of what it was up against at the time. But it was one of those shows, I think, that what keeps this show really interesting for me was the wonderful production values that it had, plus a terrific cast. I think the sight of Jenna Russell wearing a big black rubber glove and carrying a plunger is probably one of the more stark visual images from musical theatre this year. And Richard Fleischman was also terrific as well. But also, I'd agree with you, Phil, that where we were sitting on the Tuesday night, and I think you saw it on the Monday night, the sound was a little bit hit and miss. And so if you weren't familiar with the songs, such as I was, or probably John was as well, you probably wouldn't hear half the jokes that were heard in the songs. So hopefully they do fix that in subsequent runs. But I think, you know, overall, I enjoyed the show. The first act is a bit too long. And even though the show itself breaks the fourth wall and talks about, well, there's nothing that can kill a show more than too much exposition. I think they should have taken a leaf out of their own book and probably cut a little bit in that. But overall, it's a great show. And I think the anti-musical and the subject matter is part of its appeal. And that's probably why it's got a fairly young audience that was attending, present company excluded, obviously. But I think that's what is probably, from just looking at other reactions to it, I think that's what's going to keep the interest in it. Plus the unusual subject title, I suspect.
I think it's interesting that the new theatrical trend for this year has been set with pissing on stage, because the following night I went to the opening of The Full Monty, where somebody urinates on against the wall as well, which was strange seeing it two nights running, and I look forward to more of that.
Yes, there must be a discount in bladder props at the moment.
But I do think the St. James's Theatre should charge for their toilets just as a kind of stunt. And, you know, they've got...
Yes, they are wonderful, aren't they?
They're absolutely fantastic. I've taken people in to see them.
Yes, best toilets in London theatre.
I think they really should have Elaine Page sitting outside with a saucer of shillings.
I actually dashed for the toilets because I was worried that everybody would have been overwhelmed thinking about their bladders during the course of the show. But fortunately, I got in there pretty quickly. Actually, the ladies are kind of small, so it's not like I can stick my head in and see what I'm missing out on, though.
Yes, obviously a gay man might have designed the St. James Theatre toilets because they're quite spacious.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I'm quite glad that the lengthy first half wasn't attended by kind of atmospheric sound of dripping water. That would have pushed it over the edge a little bit. But I still think you're all wrong. I think it'll be very popular, and I quite liked it. So.
No, I said it would be popular too. I think the music is infectious.
Judging by the reaction at the end, although people weren't laughing at the jokes throughout the show, in the lyrics.
So what does that mean? Does it mean the preview audience is full of the friends of the cast? Or people?
Well, that's what I'm wondering.
Yeah. I just think they couldn't hear half the jokes. That was all.
There was a lot of enthusiasm at the end. A lot of people standing up.
And the music is infectious. I've been humming It's a Privilege to Pee since Tuesday.
I did like the calipers gag, though. That was my only real laugh out loud because it was so naughty.
I can't remember a single song from the show. Just nothing.
No, I can't either.
I think
I'll send you both the soundtrack then.
Yeah, in an auditorium like that, I think it matters where you sit. And I think Paul and I got a better experience because we were pretty... Oh, it's another...
Up front.
It's another wet joke. We're immersed in it because we were only about 4 rows from the stage.
Yes, wasn't Jenna Russell giving you eyes with while she was carrying the plunger?
Oh, Jenna Russell and I are now Twitter friends. I mean, this has gone beyond a joke.
But we were 3 rows from the front in the centre, so, you know, we should have been able to hear the sound there, and we couldn't.
Yes, I mean, it definitely needs tweaking, because we were getting the acoustic sound from the stage, not the blended sound from the box.
My relief was when it was over, if we're still doing that. But at least I didn't call it number twos. Are we going to keep going? Just come on, John.
Saving that for Finian's Rainbow, because that's a crook of something.
It's a very fluid production.
Yes, it's showers of gold everywhere we look today.
Yes, it shone out like a shaft of gold.
Even Andrew splashed out on a ticket to come with me.
We're now going to talk about Finian's Rainbow at the Union Theatre. Web Cowgirl, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Finian's Rainbow was written by Yip Harburg and Fred Sadie with music by Burton Lane. And to be honest, I went to this show because of Yip Harburg, who is actually a fantastic songwriter and I think well known for doing Over the Rainbow. And I figured, if nothing else, going to this, I'd actually have a chance to see songs that I would really enjoy performed live in front of me, and that was a good enough reason for me to go see it. It was done in 1947, which I think is actually pretty important if you're trying to make any sort of sense of the story. It's about an Irishman and his granddaughter who emigrate to America because the Irishman believes that if he buries a pot of gold near Fort Knox, more gold will grow out of it. And this has driven his immigrant's dream of going to America. He winds up in some small tobacco growing county somewhere in the South, where the land is full of some sort of strange combination of sharecroppers and perhaps Depression-era Dust Bowl migrants who have formed this community, which I thought was actually quite strange given race relations in America in the late 40s, because black people and white people are actually living together as a happy community. And America wasn't nearly that nice back in those days, no matter how poor you were. And from that point, any attempt to kind of summarize the plot is going to bog down in the horrible reality that it doesn't really make a lot of sense. The leprechaun wants to get his gold. The daughter of the Irish immigrant falls in love with a boy from the community. The local senator wants to kick everybody off of the land so that he can get money from the utility companies to run stuff through the property. I think that's probably enough plot. The senator's the bad guy. There's a romantic love interest. And it's actually a whole lot of fun once you just let go of any desire to have things make a whole lot of sense. However, any play that involves the leprechaun as a major character, to me, is telling the audience that you need to let go of any adherence to normal plotting. And I just accepted, you know, this is a musical and it's going to be silly, and I'm just going to sit back and let things happen. And I feel like I lucked out, but I wasn't really surprised, because the songs in it were just beautiful. They had "How Are Things in Glacamora," "Old Devil Moon," "If This Isn't Love," which is a song that I walked out of the theater singing. And there's one that isn't really more famous, but it's a song called "When the Idle Poor Become the Idle Rich," which I thought was actually still very politically relevant, because in Britain today, you see all sorts of tabloid headlines about poor people wasting their money on this or wasting their money on that. But apparently these sins that they engage in are only a problem because they're not rich. Because when you're rich, gambling and wenching and drinking are all just comic things you do to fill the time, because you've got so much time to fill. And oddly, when you're out of work, time is the one thing you have to fill. So I thought it actually still had quite a bit of relevant political satire going on in it, and done in the very confined confines of the Union Theater with, I think, over 20 people singing wonderfully and dancing quite well in front of me. I felt like I'd been popped into the middle of some kind of like 3D phantasmorama, and was just completely delighted. Unfortunately, I wasn't lucky enough to go there the night that Nick went. Nick, how'd you find it?
Yeah, I'm pretty much with you on this. I actually had, well, I don't know if recommended is the right word, but I wasn't sure whether I was going to go to this, but actually another theatre blogger who I bumped into was basically telling me, you know, if you go in just accepting that it's the most ludicrous thing on earth, it is actually a lot of fun. And that's what I did, and that's what I thought it was. I went in thinking, you know, this is going to be ridiculous, and it really is ridiculous. You think that the fact that it's a story about a man who's stolen some leprechaun gold so he can plant it at Fort Knox so it can grow is ridiculous. And then you get to the girl who's mute and can only communicate through the medium of interpretative dance. So I think, you know, you're either going to go with that or you're not. I was quite willing to just go with that, but I had been forewarned that that was the best attitude to go with it. And I think if you do go into it like that, it's huge amounts of fun. I think it's very well done. And, yeah, very, very good music. And I think, as I understand it, some of the bizarreness of the, because it is kind of meant as a kind of criticism on the racial attitudes of the time, and I think that's been watered down a bit by a subsequent rewrite. I do think it's funny that a play that's kind of trying to dispel certain racial stereotypes does that by portraying all the Irish as hard-drinking, river-dancing leprechauns. But, you know, it's American, so what do you think they're going to think the Irish are like? But, yeah, I also really enjoyed it, and but I think we might have a dissenting voice in here somewhere as well.
John? Cue the dissenting voice.
Cue the dissenting voice, yeah.
Well, on on one level, I found it very enjoyable. You know, you have a very young cast singing extremely well. They really do. They sing very, especially the girl who plays Sharon, Christina Bennington. I thought she had a beautiful voice, very, very clear and on the middle of the notes, and she sang very effortlessly some beautiful songs, no doubt about it. But for me, it was a little bit like, you know, going to an arts ed student concert. It's all about the singing. It's not really very much about the dancing, because the choreography is extremely simple. They do a lot of it, but it's mostly just stepping. It's not complicated dance moves, apart from for Susan the Silent, who, as you say, does most of her lines through the medium of interpretive dance, which, once there were a few giggles in the audience about the silliness of that, were got over. People accepted her as a reasonable character, and again, I thought she did it quite well. What I don't like about Finian's Rainbow, and I confess I've never seen the film, even though it is fascinating to imagine what a collaboration between Francis Ford Coppola and Tommy Steele would look like, I really must rent it, is the sort of historical inaccuracy of what they've done with the production. This was written, as Webb Cowgirl said, just after the Second World War in 1947, so about 10, 12 years after Porgy and Bess. So it's got something to say about race. And in the story, the aggressive landowning senator, who is, if you like, hounding the sharecroppers for ownership of the land that they're working on and the property that they're working on, because he wants to run power lines across it for profit, is incredibly bigoted and about both the Irish and the black people who live on the land.
And it's not the Irish, it's immigrants. That's important to me.
Sorry, I'm talking about the original story. He is bigoted about the Irish and bigoted about the black people. And what happens is, because he makes no effort to conceal this, and there's a moment when he is close to the crock of gold, and Sharon wishes that he could know what it was like to be black. And he changes. It's a transformation within the show. And usually it's done by casting a black and a white actor of very similar features and stature so that they can be switched. And he has to understand what it's like to be black. And the pivot of the story is that actually he's no less bigoted when he's a black man than he is when he's a white man. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that's been massaged away in this adaptation is that Woody, the young romantic lead, has a scheme, because this is tobacco land. They're growing tobacco in the southern in Virginia or somewhere like that. And he has a scheme to cross the tobacco plant with the mint plant to make tobacco which is already mentholated, which was a very popular thing in 1947. But now, of course, anything to do with smoking is considered taboo, in the same way that anything to do with race is considered taboo. And it's all been edited out of the show. It's a little bit like in Annie, where modern productions, Miss Hannigan isn't allowed to smack the orphans, which she was when the show was created. And I think if you're doing something which is a revival of a historical piece, you're obliged to use the mores of the time in which the show was staged. So, you know, first of all, we're on the tobacco plantations and nobody smokes. Secondly, we're doing a show about race in which the whole pivot of this story, where a white man becomes a black man and turns back again, is not used. It just seems an extra layer of nonsense to a play which is already very nonsensical. And whereas the nonsensical aspects of the leprechaun and the magic are whimsical and pleasant, I think editing out the serious political point that the show might have to make is doing it a disservice, and I did not like it because of that. However, I have to say, everybody's having a good time. It's a very prettily staged piece. The kids on stage are all good. There are no weak links in the ensemble, and so it seems rather a shame to pee on it like that. But I did not think that. I think it's the adaptation that I really did not like. The workmanship of everybody else involved is beyond criticism.
I'm going to disagree with you and have a sort of a little conversation with you about taking musicals and having new stagings require recreating the way things were done originally. A particular case in point, Rodgers and Hammerstein, the one set in Chinatown, help me here, that has I Enjoy Being a Girl in it. Anyone coming up?
Flower Drum Song?
Yeah. When Flower Drum Song, if you try to set Flower Drum Song in a way that represents how white people saw Chinese Americans in the 1960s, I don't don't think anyone would want to see it because it's just disgusting. But
you follow that to the logical conclusion, and no one would ever do The King and I.
The King and I is about prejudice on both sides, though. And I think there's some questions about, I haven't seen a revival of The King and I in the 7 years I've been here. So maybe it is becoming less popular. But
You must have missed the one around for 3 weeks at the Albert Hall.
Yeah, I did miss that. But I think that when you're reviving musicals, that it is reasonable to update them. But I think stripping out the thing about the menthol cigarettes is actually kind of unfortunate. That's really funny. But the thing about smacking the orphans, I think that's actually historically accurate for Annie and not just for the production that you saw. It's an historically accurate way of representing how children were treated at that time.
So which side of this argument are you on? You should do them in the mores of the time, or you shouldn't.
Yes, what I'm saying is I disagree that you must replay musicals in exactly the same style as they were originally presented. And in some ways, the music is what holds the musical together. And sometimes, in order to save the music, you may have to change quite a bit of the musical. But when I hear the comments that you made about this show, I think I would have seen a production that actually hit me a lot harder if they had stuck to making the de facto depiction of what it means to be a poor man as being black, but also seeing that character show that he was just as much of a hateful man as a black man as he had been a white man. I think that would have also been like a pretty important message. So I think that I would have seen a very different production, but because what I saw was still a good show, to me, I just think there's different ways of presenting this that are still valid. And I think that the way that they did this show created a good show, and they didn't have to do it like it was done originally in order to make it work.
I think, actually, in the context of this whole discussion, one thing that's interesting that I remember from the program notes is that Phil Wilmore had intended to do his own adaptation of it, because this adaptation is, according to the credits, is adapted by Charlotte Moore, so I think this is kind of an older adaptation that kind of toned it down. I think he had his own intentions of how to kind of adapt it, that it wasn't going to be quite as heavy-handed as that, as what's ended up with, but the rights holders were going to let him do his own rewrite, and then they changed their mind, so they said he had to use this one. So it was interesting to me that, that this whole discussion came up, because obviously it fits into, what his ideas of what he actually wanted to do with it did involve a rewrite, just not necessarily the one he had to use. I think, like anything, it makes a difference whether you're familiar with the piece beforehand or not. I wasn't, so, given how ridiculous everything else was, the fact that none of the plot made a huge amount of sense didn't bother me that much. But, finding out, definitely the thing about crossbreeding the tobacco does make sense of why, as far as you can tell from this version, everybody kind of is going, oh, Woody's going to save us, and that's it. I have no idea why he was going to save them, but apparently that's it. He had his plan.
That actually makes sense. God forbid we've got one piece of the plot mystery worked out at last. But I got to say, John, if you were running a production house doing Show It Like It Was productions and musicals, I would absolutely come and see it. But I have a feeling that you wouldn't be getting a lot of transfers.
Thing is, Rainbow has an interesting performance history. It's never run properly in Britain. I think the was it at the Victoria Palace many, many years ago, and only around 55 performances. But the most recent revival with Cheyenne Jackson on Broadway, I think it was 2009, and was quite well received. That has the character of the Southern Senator accidentally turning black. So if they weren't afraid of it, I really don't know where this shift in adaptation has come from. I think the lady that Nick mentioned did a version of it for the theatre in Dublin. It could well be it's Irish sensibilities that are being protected. I don't know. But definitely it was a very, very strong black cast in the show on Broadway.
To me, it was really amazing to see a show written in 1947 in which a black character talked about going to university. That was I think that's probably the first mention of Black people going for higher education. I mean, certainly in musical theater, but possibly in American theater. And that was great for me to see. And she also, the character, you know, the most famous Black actress, I guess, shortly before that, had been the woman from Gone with the Wind. And that kind of role had been what Black actors got when they were playing in shows that were like primarily white people. And this one actually embraced the fact that there was a real culture going on at the same time, which you pretty much just didn't see in the white theater. And I'm actually sorry that this play was so focused on the white folks, because there was a whole bunch of strong actors just sitting there and waiting to support a really rich story, and they didn't really get the opportunity.
We're now going to talk about Night of the Burning Pestle. This is the second production at the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse at the Globe Theatre. It's by Francis Beaumont and directed by Adele Thomas. It was originally done as a children's production. It was very big in early Jacobean plays, where you got children doing all the parts. There's a usually cut line from Hamlet about a nest of children, I think, where the players in Hamlet talk about being chased out by a nest of children, I think. And it was very, very popular at the time, and I find it somewhat disturbing in other plays, things like Women Beware Women, where you get little boys having to kiss each other for the entertainment of grown men, which was what happens quite a lot in that play. Fortunately, it's not quite so bad in this play, and this play is a lot of fun. There were a lot of lines in it where the grocer's wife refers to them being little children, and it doesn't quite make sense when she's talking to a grown man. This play is kind of a play within a play. We start off, we think we're going to watch a play called The London Merchant, but a couple of people in the audience start speaking up. These are the grocer and his wife, who decide that they don't really want to see some dull comedy about a London merchant. They'd much rather introduce their apprentice Rafe into the mix and have him do a completely different story. So what we get is the actors desperately trying to continue on doing the London merchant while the grocer and his wife start telling them to insert these scenes with Rafe in them, and Rafe becomes the knight with the burning pestle. And sometimes the scenes relate to the London merchant, and other times they're just complete fantasies. Nick, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
The word postmodern's getting used a lot to describe this, which is how it feels. I mean, which is interesting when it's a few centuries too early. And I think it wasn't particularly popular in its time. I think people didn't necessarily get it, but I think it makes a lot of sense. Well, it doesn't make sense, obviously. That's certainly one thing it doesn't make. But the kind of idea behind it, we understand, I think, now things at play with the structure of it. And it's very, really sophisticated in that sense, because it's kind of a play within a play within a play. And it's just incredibly silly and incredibly funny. I mean, I was laughing really hard through a lot of it. And apart from the fact that it's ever so slightly too long, it runs at a full 3 hours. And I think there's possibly a few too many little songs in there that could have been cut. Apart from that, there's very little I can fault with it. It's just so entertaining. And it's got these three distinct levels of where the comedy works. Because the London Merchant works as a spoof of a sort of romantic comedy drama of the time, and the cast have got a very distinct, there's very distinct levels where you can see which part of the story they're in at any given time. So the performances, you've got the two kind of rival lovers. You've got Dick and Tyrrell, who's playing kind of the comic relief ridiculous one, and he's got these terrible succession of rhyming couplets. And Alex Waldman is playing the intended lead of it, and he's got these lovely kind of ridiculously overly literal gestures that he does when he's acting with a capital A. And they're kind of fighting for the hand of Luce, who's played by Sarah McRae. Meanwhile, when you've got these two characters in the audience, and you've got Pauline McGlynn playing the grocer's wife, she's constantly misinterpreting everything about the play. So she horribly takes against the romantic lead and much prefers the comic relief and thinks he's actually the lead. You've got this commentary there, and then also there's the third level, which is the play that's being made up as it goes along that they've inserted into it, that they ever so often demand comes back to with Rafe, which is Matthew Needham, who's very, very good, I think, in the part. He's got a kind of clumsy likability to him in the character. He just kind of goes along with it because his bosses have said, oh, you're going to be the star of the show now. Oh, okay. For me, the bits where it's absolutely glorious is when these three levels kind of crash together. And as it goes on, the prepared play and the made-up play that's going along alongside it sort of start to crash, and characters from the main play decide they'd actually quite like to be in the Night of the Burning Pestle play instead. So they cross over and go, oh, no, actually, I quite like him. I'll go be one of his followers. And it's very silly. I think it's so well put together. I think the director, Adele Thomas, I think has found every little moment that you could of sort of physical comedy and how to kind of play a line to its funniest potential. I just think this is great fun.
Yeah, I agree. And the only problem I had with it was by the end of it, I was just worn out, because although I'd been laughing, it just felt too long. I think on the night I went, I got out about 10 to 11. And there was a very early preview. I think they might have cut it down.
Oh, no, they've definitely cut it down. It is 3 hours. Yeah. It is half ten now. It still feels a bit too much. It does also have, padding it out, these little extra intervals, which I think are kind of there for authenticity. They're these little 4 minute intervals in addition to the main 15 minute interval. And to be honest, given the seating there, which is already, I think, quite notoriously uncomfortable, I didn't mind the opportunity to stand up and sort of stretch my legs for a couple of seconds before the next act. So I didn't mind that, but I think there were certain parts of the story that could have been cut down. I think actually what's going to be interesting, given how you started talking about this, is the next show there, which obviously is trying to recreate the company of boys. The Malcontent is going to have although I don't think it's going to be all male, so they have kind of enlisted a company of sort of teenage actors to do that. I think there's some very interesting stuff going on in The Wanamaker, but I've not gone for the restricted views so far, and I think I've been right to it. I think if you're going to go see something there, you have to kind of fork out for at least sort of a pit seat if you want to see anything, because from what I'm hearing, the restricted views are ridiculously restricted. But apart from that, I think what's actually going on the stage has been very interesting so far in there.
It is interesting on this to see the idea that people interrupt the plays. I mean, you see it in Shakespeare, where people, any time you have a play on, everybody's talking over it and interrupting it. And this is very much in that theme of talking over and interrupting. And it's very much how, you know, theatre used to be before they were able to turn the lights off properly.
I think is very interesting about that is that it's so, I mean, obviously it's created for this kind of theatre, but I think I'm quite impressed that they picked this for their first season, because it so shows off the dynamics of the space. Because I think the first time you go in there, you kind of realise how it sort of is like a miniature version of the Globe, but it is so miniature and so squashed up that you really feel like you're kind of sitting on top of the actors and they're kind of sitting on top of you half the time. So you can see where a play like this that blurs the line so much makes sense in this kind of space, even if, as it turns out, you know, when it was first produced, people didn't really appreciate it much. But you can see where kind of the triple blurring of who belongs in what part of the story would have come about in this sort of space.
So, Julie, what did you think about Night of the Burning Pestle?
I really enjoyed it. I liked it a lot more than I enjoyed Duchess of Malfi. Though I enjoyed Duchess of Malfi, what I thought about that was, in a way, it ticked lots of boxes. So how can we use the candles to do this, light up the faces? How can we use the inner stage? How can we run round the side of the stage? So I felt with the Duchess of Malfi, it was lots of boxes ticked in terms of how they use the space. But I was actually wanting a bit more of that
engagement with the audience because the audience is sat right next to them, basically. So actually coming into the night of the burning pestle, I thought, actually, that's doing all the things that I would want that space to do, because you can't ignore the fact you've got an audience right in front of you. And that interaction was really interesting for me. So I thought it was really funny. I love the meta theatre. I love the moment when the citizens come into the theatre, sit down and do all the rattling of the nuts and giving the nuts out to everybody around them. And I love the bit where suddenly Jasper and Lou, Sarah McRae and Alex Waldman, kind of you see them looking as if they're annoyed by the fact that the performance is going to be interrupted by these people in the audience, and there's modern day connotations there as well. And then the idea that you've got all these narratives interlaid, so you've got the merchant's tale, you've then got this kind of spoof on a romantic comedy where Rafe the apprentice gets on stage and he becomes the knight of the burning pestle, and he kind of develops and grows in that role, and you just actually fall in love with him, his eyes and his face and the way that he kind of interacts with everything going on. You've got that discussion, that narrative, and then you've got the wider narrative of the citizens, the merchants interacting with the main narrative as well and commenting on it and getting really involved. And it's a, I suppose it's a modern day version of us all tweeting through something we're watching on television, you know, commenting on what's happening and acting as if Jasper's really a real character. I loved all that. And then I started to think a little bit more about the production, and I thought, yes, there is audience interaction, but it's really with other actors, because obviously the citizens are actors in the audience. And I think as it goes through its run, there'll be a lot more confidence in the production to interact with the wider audience a bit more. I've seen it twice. I saw it on its opening preview. And I thought, it, you know, for an opening preview night, it was very good, but far too long. And they needed to lose about 30 minutes. And I think they've got that down. But then I saw it again where Matthew Needham had hurt his knee and he was on crutches. So that gave it another layer because he couldn't do the fight scenes or anything physical. So we had a brilliant moment where Matthew Needham stood on stage on his crutches and Alex Waldman's running around the side of the theatre fighting with himself. You hear all the clattering, the ouches. At one point, his face splattered across the window. And you know that the person he's having this fight with, he's actually stood on stage laughing. So that added another dimension, which I thought worked really well. I don't think Matthew Needham's on crutches now. I think his knee's okay. But they were jumping off the stage from a wooden stage onto a wooden floor, so you can see how somebody's going to get hurt. And when I was thinking about where they could cut, I was thinking, well, the interludes, the little intervals, because people are unsure what to do with those intervals. Do they go out? Do they stay where they are? And it occurred to me, well, you've got to have them for Phil Daniels and the other actress, because if they didn't have those breaks, they would be actually on stage, as it were, for the whole thing. So I thought maybe the breaks were for them as well, to kind of give them a moment to get out and go out and come back in. But it was confusing for some people, and there was instances where people had gone out for longer than just to stretch their feet, and then they were coming back and trying to get into the seats when the play was continuing. But overall, for me, this was more successful than Duchess of Malfi. But it does make me raise some of those questions about what are they going to do now they've had these experiments? Are they going to spend the next 20 years trying to do Renaissance Jacobean plays in what they think is this authentic space, trying to get to what it would have looked like at the time? Or is there any room to experiment and do different things with it for the actors to kind of develop the roles in the production? Or is it they just going to go for this original practice notion for the whole time? Because I'd like to see them using the space for lots of different experiments. And maybe, you know, not everything being in the traditional costumes, just trying to think, oh, what could we do with it? We talked about the candles. I thought the candles, them playing about with lighting them and the candelabras moving up and down, I thought that was fun as well. So, yeah, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'd definitely like to see some modern stuff there. Yeah. And even some, you know, sort of not quite so modern stuff, like, you know, a Pinter or two or even a Chekhov might work quite well, yeah, in the space.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's what's, for me, now that's what I want to see. Let's try something. You've got this beautiful, intimate space. I think there is the issue about the comfort, isn't there? That's coming up over and over again. You know, leg room, looking in the pit where you're looking opposite. Though I must admit, I quite like the pit. I like that the best, especially if you're in the back rows because you're more at stage height. But yeah, do something really interesting with the space, because you've got a beautiful, intimate space with the audience. That I think, you know, what the Night of the Burning Pestle does really well is it was grabbing the audience really quickly, and they were getting involved and cheering and clapping and becoming part of it. And I think, you know, with something else, you could experiment with drawing that audience right into your production.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook. On the web, we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.